Saul of Tarsus, from his birth to the stoning of Stephen. Rome and Jerusalem stood alone as the greatest cities of the first century. One was the capital of a vast Roman Empire that extended from foggy Britain to the hot deserts of North Africa, and from sunny Spain and the great sea to the west that receives the sun at night, to Assyria, past Mesopotamia in the east. The other was Jewish, a 3 million population thorn in Rome's side, capital of worldwide Judaism. Athens, Corinth, and Ephesus vied with each other for second place in the renowned cities of the ancient world. Athens was the intellectual capital of the world. Ephesus was the capital of the worship of Diana, who fell down from heaven unto them, so the story goes. And she was the chief port of Asia Minor, and a prosperous merchant city, for all trade ships passed by her to Greece and Rome in the west, Syria and Palestine in the east, and to Egypt and Africa to the south. Corinth was the capital of religious prostitution, having 1,000 Greek priestesses for religious sexual experiences in one temple alone. No one disputed her reputation as the capital of moral debauchery. Majoring in licentious Greek and Roman sports, arts, and theaters, the city of two seas, by reason of her hand-hewn canal to the hard rock, was crowded with trading vessels and was very wealthy. Saul was not born in the Holy Land, as Jesus or his apostles were, nor in any of these worldly cities of note. But he would brag to the Roman tribune in his defense, "I am a Jew, a Tarsian of Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city." Strabo says it was more famous than Athens and Alexandria, the latter noted for its papyri, linen, wheat, and learning. Rome ruled Asia Minor from the ancient city, made a free Roman city by Mark Antony, giving his citizen the privilege of self-government without a Roman garrison being stationed there. Tarsus, some 10 miles inland on the Cindus River, was located inland as a precaution against pirates, the ancient plague of the Sicilian coast. This city of 500,000 souls received the bulk of its trade at a port engineered in the middle of a lake on the river, several miles south. The heavy ships could navigate the river safely no further north. From there, donkey and carts hauled the goods overland. Smaller craft, as all the ships when Tarsus was first situated, sailed up the river right into the city center and unloaded. So came Cleopatra's private barge, with its lamps burning on the water, purple sails and all, to affect Mark Antony's heart. Tarsus had its head in the hills that they chiseled a road through, and its feet resting on a great inland river harbor. 1,000 years old at the time of Saul, from Ionian Greek colonies and Tarsus natives on the Cindus River, the city of Japhethites housed a Shemite that would become the most famous name in Christendom. Cyrus had marched through Tyrus with 10,000 Greek mercenaries. Alexander the Great had marched 10,000 Greek soldiers through Tarsus. Antiochus Epiphanes gave the city more autonomy. Tarsus did not rebel at his Hellenization, like Jerusalem did, so escaped its fate. Indeed, after Alexander visited the city, it became more Greek again. The Jews in Tarsus showed a great deal more tolerance for Greek culture than Palestinian Jews. Pompey brought all Cilicia under Roman rule in 65 B.C. Cicero governed there in 51 B.C. His first job was to drive the bandits out of the hill country. Asia Minor welcomed the Romans to restore order and strife in the struggle with Orientalism, for the remarkable Mithridates, king of Pontus, had spread anarchy and social breakdown throughout all Asia Minor in the east. The Jews of the dispersion were an urban people, involved in commerce and finance. Above all, they needed peace, and Pompey found these Jews as useful core group to influence peace and order. Tarsus was a university town, a resort of learned men, the seat of Stoic philosophy. Saul was well acquainted with the workshops, although he leaned to the books and teaching, for it was Jewish law, not Roman law, that compelled each Jewish father to send his sons first to book school, then to trade school. He who does not send his boy to school teaches him to become a thief, Rabbi Judah said. And Rabbi Gamaliel said, he that hath a trade in his hand, what is he like? He is like a vineyard that is fenced. Rabbi Joseph turned a mill. Rabbi Judah was a baker. Rabbi Ada was a fisherman. Rabbi Saul would be a tent maker. He learned to weave the black hair of eastern goats into tent cloth at school. Thus every Jew was secure in a trade, should he be persecuted and driven from his profession or business. Paul would one day hold up his worker's hands in the pulpit at Ephesus and declare, these hands have ministered to mine own necessities and to those who are with me and are dependent upon me, that we be not chargeable to you, that you might learn to support the weak. Saul of Tarsus, like Timothy of Lystra, from a child knew the Holy Scriptures, and he thirsted for more and aspired to be a teacher of them. Living in all good conscience, he shunned the Greco-Roman theaters, stadium, baths, and temples. He instead faithfully attended the synagogue in the Jewish quarter. If his son had the intelligence, propensity, and drive, every Jewish father desired his son to become a rabbi. Few did. Saul had both zeal and a keen mind. Earlier, across the miles, another worker's son had also zeal and a keen mind. One in Tarsus, one in Little Nazareth. The one in Tarsus, by special talents, was chosen to travel to Jerusalem and sit at the feet of a rabbi in Judaism, a rare privilege for the lad, and a costly one. His tutor would be the new Rabbi Gamaliel, just 30 years old, but the grandson of the famous Hillel. The other boy, at age 12, would also hear and question the doctors of the law at Jerusalem. The learned Simeon, father of Gamaliel, was undoubtedly one of them. Into their midst walks one sincere, zealous lad, and they are so amazed at such a boy, so full of wisdom and strength of spirit, that they discourse with him. 20 years later, he will put them to silence and embarrassment, and they will vote to have him crucified. Many years after the boy from Tarsus enrolls at Gamaliel's school, he is arrested, and 9 years later, he is put to death in Nero's court. Saul, an apostle to both the Jews and the Gentiles, was a Jewish Pharisee and leader of a synagogue in Jerusalem. He was a Roman citizen, brought up in a city of Asian and Greek culture in a Jewish home. He could talk like a Hebrew scholar and quote Greek poets and Sicilian Stoics before the philosophers of Athens. He could write in Attic and Koine Greek for his complex sentences and letters to his churches and converse in Aramaic in Jerusalem. God's hand of destiny was moving men of influence and means. Soon he would open the doors and Saul would get both stones and converts. After his conversion, Saul would leave off his Hebrew name Saul and be called by his Roman name Paul. For the Jews of the diaspora took either Greek or Roman names to better hide their identity when it was commodious to do so. Two of Paul's Jewish kinsmen, Junia and Lucius, had Roman names. Andronicus, Herodian, Timotheus, half-Jewish, half-Greek, Lucius, Jason, and Sosipater are Greek names. Saul was a Roman citizen, not by some special act he did, or by paying a large sum of money, nor by him being released from slavery, as some say. For he himself declares, I was free-born, to the chief captain over the Roman fort Antonia, who said that he purchased his Roman citizenship with a great sum of money. Nor was Paul a Roman citizen because he was born in the free city of Tarsus, as others say. For he told the chief captain that he was a native of Tarsus. But the chief captain was greatly surprised later to learn that he was a Roman citizen. Paul was free-born because his father or grandfather was granted Roman citizenship. This could be purchased at great cost, awarded by great service, or more commonly, by being a slave set at liberty. Many of the Jews who were taken to Rome by Pompeius as slaves were afterwards released to become libertini, being registered as citizens of Rome for this injustice. Saul was a Hebrew of the seed of Abraham and Benjamin, circumcised the eighth day, his parents being strict Jews also. He was a Hebrew of the Hebrews, meaning that he was brought up as a conservative Hebrew who retained all the old ways, customs, languages, and so forth, and did not assimilate himself to the Greek, Roman, and Gentile ways as many other Jews of the dispersion did. This was considered to them to be superior. Not only was he a Pharisee, a separatist, but his father also was a Pharisee. At the age of 5, he began to memorize scripture. At 10, the Mishnah, which is a handbook of legal determinations in the utmost logical sequences, only enlivened by discussions or tale of instances in point. And it was very anti-messianic. At 13, he became an avid student of the law. And in a ceremony, he was called a child of the law, his father testifying in the presence of the synagogue that his son fully understood the law and was therefore fully responsible for his sins. This was not dreaded by Jewish boys. It was a big day, for it meant that they were now on par with adults, a young man. Probably at this time, Saul was favored to be sent to Jerusalem to complete his training under Gamaliel, for Paul himself says that he was brought up in Jerusalem and that he was a youth there. Often he had heard Hebrew pilgrims from the interior of Asia Minor come down to the mountain passes and join others in Tarsus, bound for the holy city they had read about all his young life. Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek there. David and Solomon had their palaces there. There was God's temple. It was the apple of God's eye. The pilgrims returned after the feast with presents from there and great tales of feasts and greatness of the magnificent temple of learned and venerated teachers and of the great walls and turrets on it, over 40 forts about the suburbs, two outer walls alone. Young Saul, as every Jewish child in far-off places, longed to grow up and go there. And now, young Saul got his chance. He would believe everything he was taught. His teacher would be the most strict in morals, and yet broad enough in the law to avoid the great excesses of legalism that was so then prevalent in the capital city. Saul would not travel the tortuous land route through the mountain passes of Emmaus to Syrian Antioch, and from there along the rugged Phoenician shore through Tyre and Sidon to Jerusalem. He was but a youth, and his parents had money, or he wouldn't be sent abroad to school. He would board a ship on the river that flowed through town on a Phoenician trader. His father would go with him at the next feast after he was 13 years old. The Roman warships had chased the pirates from the seas, for they plied them by the thousands, always looking for pirates as they traveled. Sailing around the headland of Carmel at 4 knots, the heavy sailing ship docked at the Roman garrison city of Caesarea, a 400-mile journey, including tacking into the wind. The ships of the first century had very primitive and inefficient hull and sail designs. One large mast with strong ropes through a block at the masthead, and one large sail fastened on an enormous yard. Instead of the strain being distributed over the hull as in modern ships, it was concentrated on a smaller area, causing leakage at times under severe stress. A topsail was often used, and oftentimes more than one mast. Early ships often broke up in storms, and their fastenings loosened. Josephus himself and his companions saved themselves from a foundering ship by swimming all night, probably with the aid of floating spars, and so forth. Often they were forced to throw their cargo overboard in storms. It was customary to take to sea long ropes to throw ahead of the ship to sail over and pull tight around the hull to keep the planks from loosening in storms. Not a little bucket brigade bailing would be necessary at such times. Some of the ships were quite large, as may be seen by the grain ship that Paul was headed to Rome in, that broke up on the rocks of Miletus after 2 weeks of foundering in the storm. There were 276 passengers, counting the crew on her. Ptolemy Philadelphus' ship, built at Alexandria, was a wooden vessel between 1,000 and 1,100 tons in weight, about twice the size of the ship that went aground in Miletus. This was the maximum size of ships in those days. By comparison, the Mayflower that brought the pilgrims to Plymouth a millennium and a half later was only 160 tons, one-third of the size of ship Paul sailed on. The ancient ships could not tack well into the wind, not better than 7 points near the wind. Paul's ship could not look at the wind, he says. They had to let her run with the wind, which they were very apt at. Crete was said to be 4 days sailing from Alexandria in good weather, a 310-mile voyage as the crow flies, 3.2 knots per hour, although the ship probably cut through the ocean at closer to 5 or 6 knots per hour. 100 to 150 miles in 24 hours was the common speed, 4 to 6 knots. The Mediterranean was busy with ships. Sicily was called the storehouse of Italy. The city of Rome itself exported nothing. Africa sent furniture woods to Rome and heavy cargoes of marble and granite. Rome was the big buyer, especially of corn from Egypt, much of it for the slave labor. Of course, all coastal towns with harbors engaged in the trading game. 3 to 6 days, the Phoenician ship that carried young Saul would sail south, and he would see many other sails on all horizons. Once close to shore, the craft would anchor at night to avoid hitting rocks and sandbars, for much of the coastline had no houses or towns, and the lights in these could not be seen far at sea, for the windows were covered with shutters and were doused at bedtime. And there were no night lights. Navigation was not precise. Often the ships would follow the coastline by day and anchor by night. Palestine, from the border of Egypt to Mount Carmel, was one grand sweep of ocean surf-swept coast with an outer river or surf break. Hence, it was full of sandbars. Joppa was its only harbor, but it was too fiercely Jewish and anti-Roman for Caesar to trust his military operations of Palestine to in the event of Jewish uprisings. So Herod the Great, in his "I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine" move toward Rome, built a Greco-Roman city of splendid palaces, racecourse, stadium, theaters, amphitheater, and a Roman-engineered underground sewage system at great taxpayer expense. And to top it off, his workmen spent 12 years constructing the world-famous harbor, a great engineering feat, for a very large circuit breakwater was to nearly enclose the bay from the ocean. Large barges with huge cranes and counterbalance stones slowly let down giant sawn limestone blocks 18 foot wide by 50 foot long and 9 foot thick into a 120 foot deep ocean. A wall was built around part of the outer edges, and the hotels for mariners and warehouses were constructed on the 200 foot wide mole and quay, along with numerous forts for protection of the fleet. This new city stole much of the shipping trade from Joppa to the south. Rounding the mountain head of Carmel, Saul's ship slipped into Caesarea's splendid new haven. Saul saw thousands of sails within the giant circuitous mole. There were boats and costumes from all over the great sea, Roman, Greek, Cyprian, Egyptian, Tyrrhenian, Corsican, Sardinian, and Cretan. The great harbor was a hub of activity, and there were still sails on the western horizon heading into port. Stevedores loaded and unloaded heavy, cumbersome trading ships. Engineers inspected and tightened fittings, a common and necessary maintenance routine. What a lovely, splendid, brand-new city this was. Everything was so clean. The inns on the quays were jammed with boat traders getting their first hot meal after several days, even weeks, at sea. Houses and public buildings of white marble sparkled clean and white in the sunlight. Its ordered streets, pillars, and marble buildings set in beautiful gardens impressed young Saul. But his eye colored everything non-Jewish as belonging to the hostile, immoral societies of the world. Instead of the temple of God, Saul saw the gigantic temple of the Emperor Caesar Augustus towering above other structures in the city. Nearby merchants from many lands in their strange costumes assembled and chattered about their unladen wares in the wool market. Bales of wool were being unloaded from camel trains for sale and for continued transportation in the sea lanes. Buyers from Tyre in their multicolored mantles felt and tested the wool and began to bargain, paying in Tyrrhenian drachmas. Slaves carried the white fluffy bales to the sailboats at dockside. The lad and his father, with other pilgrims to Jerusalem, passed by the long arcade made up of marble pillars with cross beams of cedar over which lay great sheets of white woven material. A bustling crowd jammed the booths that were piled high with dyed cloths, utensils of wool, silver and brass and tin. Cedar wood furniture inlaid with black ebony, baskets, pottery, leather goods, lamps, oil, everything was for sale here. Even images of male and female gods poured in Corinthian bronze or sculpted in alabaster marble. And food, sweet pomegranates, dates, figs, raisins, oranges, citron, mandrakes, cheese, fish, mutton, all sorts of food. In shadowy niches of the arcade, pretty young women lingered singly, making covert signs to male passerbys. Drunken sailors hung on the necks of one or two women and sang off-key songs as they swaggered by. Saul's father drew him along quickly past all this debauchery, looking straight forward with a stoical face. Of course, Saul had seen all this at Tarsus, too, but he still felt its shame. The father did not slacken his pace till he came to the Jewish quarter of the city. There they stopped at a khan, or inn. Jewish camel drivers were sprawled out under canvas awnings, spread on ropes under the yard, resting. Here they ate their first hot meal in several days. Mutton stew, roasted lentils, flat loaves of leavened bread, camel's milk, and dates, a real treat. "My father, let me learn from you," young Saul uttered as he reclined at dinner, speaking now that he was an adult son. "The Gentiles serve idols and practice abominations, and they do not observe the laws and commandments of God, but follow evil as we have seen today. Yet God does not punish them. Why? He punishes only us, and he has made them masters over us." "Why this is so, my son, I do not know," the father answered. It is not for us to question God's ways, but to accept them as best. But the sages and the men of Holy Writ look deeply into such matters. They penetrate the mysteries of God. To them, reasons are unveiled. One day you will be one of them, my son, and you will start soon. At 30 you will be ready. All my life I have dreamt of a man sprung from my loins who would be sanctified in the study of the Torah so that my later years would be illuminated by him. What must I do to be worthy of the Torah, father? The young prodigy asked. I have heard a word of the sages that the Torah can be purchased only at the highest price. He that would obtain the Torah must eat dry bread, drink water by measure, and sleep in the hard earth. He must be a servant of his teacher, and stand before him as a slave stands before his lord. For your rabbi shall be more to you than a father. Are you prepared, my son, to pay the price? I am, father. I seek only God at any price, the eager lad answered resolutely. As they left the inn, both father and son joined a whole caravan of pilgrims to the holy city. At every town they filled the whole marketplace. As they mounted the hills of Judea towards Jerusalem, the rock echoed with the piping of flutes as the long procession of traveling Jews made their way home to the land of their fathers and the site of Solomon's temple, now rebuilt by Herod after taking Zerubbabel's inferior temple down. Saul said wistfully, Father, I know I'm going up to Jerusalem to dedicate my life and remain. Will I see you every feast? Yes, my son, yes you will, his father assured him. And the great city came into view. Saul's first look at the venerated city of God. How great is this holy place, the youngster thought. Surely God is here. My, how impressive were the massive walls with the many forts. But the temple of God, covering 9 of our typical residential blocks, was overpowering with the enormously high pillared buildings called porches all around the perimeter, and the majestic sanctuary in the center of white marble with 10,000 square foot of gold in the face of its porch. Here young Saul lived and learned and molded his life. Saul was about 18 or 19 years old when Christ started his ministry in Galilee, and about 22 when Christ was crucified. Naturally, he saw and heard Christ, and heard much about him. All warnings, rumors, and twisted truths, of course. Gamaliel was probably only 39 years old at this time, but he was already greatly venerated, being the chief ornament and the most brilliant scholar of the school of Hillel, his grandfather. His father Simeon may have been the same Simeon who held the baby Jesus in his arms, but this is by no means certain. Saul had been molded into a Christ-hater by his very Pharisaic learning and by all the interpretations of the leading rabbis. Gamaliel was no more his private tutor. He now studied all the scrolls of the rabbis of note before him, the Torah and the Mishnah and the Law, and he discoursed with and learned from the leading scribes of all, which colored his views of the new prophet and miracle worker from Nazareth. He ate the poison of his elders and became greatly incensed that this impostor come to tear down the very fabric of Phariseeism that he had given his life to. Angry that this heretic, who desecrated the laws of Moses, still lived on in his disciples, the Greek New Testament makes it clear that he consented to the death of Stephen with gladness. The public stoning of Stephen by the highest council of the land was a clear signal to the Pharisees and chief priests. Now a storm of persecution broke loose in Jerusalem, and Saul was one of the most zealous disciples of the persecution. As the new president of the Synagogue of the Libertines and a new rabbi of the most famous names in Jerusalem, Saul turned all his Christ-hitting zeal loose on the duped disciples of the new way, all to the glory of God, he thought. Of his actions, he afterward admits that he made havoc of the church, entering presumptuously into every house of suspect, grilling the occupants to see if they would speak against Jesus of Nazareth. If not, he had them drug out of their homes by the police of the city and committed to prison till they had been tried by the overcrowded Sanhedrin court, which Saul kept busy from morning till night. Thousands were beaten and warned or imprisoned. The kangaroo court ran the accused through an assembly line of precedent. I punished them often in every synagogue, Paul admits, and I compelled them to blaspheme by forcing them to declare Jesus to be a bastard son, a heretic and deceiver, or else be beaten and imprisoned. Beyond measure, I persecuted the church of God and wasted it. I was a blasphemer in my ignorance and misguided zeal, and a persecutor. He was the champion of the Pharisees, chief priests, Sanhedrists, and scribes. Having special authority from the chief priest, Paul condemned many and witnessed against them, giving his consent to mobs to stone them to death. But God would show this zealot of Pharisaic zealots who caused the lovers of Jesus to suffer so, what great sufferings he must endure at the hands of his compatriots when the light of Jesus shone on his pathway. Christ was the first martyr, Stephen the second, and others would follow them to receive the crown of Jesus reserved for those who gave their lives, not counting them dear, for the name and cause of Christ. And apostles would be named among them, even the name of Saul, the persecutor from Tarsus. The stoning of Stephanus brought to an end the temporary protection of Christ's followers, occasioned by the advice of Gamaliel. Now the high court had put their blessing on Antichrist activism, and the chief priests and scribes were quick to follow suit while Rome turned its head and let the Jews solve their own religious squabbles in their own way. After all, it took the attention off of the injustices of the heathen oppressor from far-off Italy that gave Rome some respite from Israel's zealots. After Stephen was stoned, Saul may have replaced an aging councilman, for later he says that he gave his vote against the Christians, not only men but women also, he admitted. Saul's name became feared as the destroyer of them who called on Christ's name in Jerusalem. His fame was in all the synagogues, near and far. Fear seized the church. They dare not enter a synagogue or witness openly, and if they were known, they would be seized, even in their own home. They could not meet in the temple, and if their friends weakened under the lash and told their name, they would be sought out. And so the stomp of the Supreme Court on the disciples of Christ scattered the flaming coals of fire all over Palestine, thus fulfilling the first part of the prophecy of the Master, for he had said, "Ye shall be witnesses of me in Jerusalem, and in all Judea, and in Samaria, and unto the uttermost parts of the earth." Indeed, the persecution at Jerusalem forced the young churches to fulfill Christ's commission to them, and they would continue to be fulfilled till all the world was preached to. Then Jesus will return. They were all scattered abroad except the apostles, Luke wrote. But this probably was a general term referring to those who were preaching, teaching, and witnessing very publicly. And if it means more than this, it probably includes a great bulk of the church, those most in danger. The Lord had told them that if they are persecuted, to flee to another city. Go through the open doors, the great teachers were saying. Thus, seeing that the door of effective evangelism had closed in Jerusalem, and that the fury against the church could not be brought to an end in any other way, they fled the city with Christ's permission. Indeed, the apostles probably urged them to go and carry the torch of truth everywhere as commanded. God's design at Pentecost was to spread his spirit over all the lost sheep of Israel. The apostles were no hirelings and would follow the example of their rabbi who had taught them that the servant is not greater than his master. They would stay in the city and trust God who had delivered them already. Whether they lived or died, they were the Lord's. They would let him decide their fate, and he did. He let them live. And they won more converts, and the church grew, but not in Solomon's porch. Later, when Saul became converted and came back to Jerusalem from Antioch, where he had pursued the believers of Jesus, he tried to join the disciples of Christ, showing that he knew of their existence there. When the door of the gospel was opened to the Gentiles, the apostle and brethren at Jerusalem heard of it. Later, Herod persecuted the church at Jerusalem. James was killed and Peter imprisoned, but the church of that city prayed without ceasing for him until he was released. Later, Paul and Barnabas took the dissenting Judaizers before the church at Jerusalem to settle a theological dispute. And the whole church agreed with Paul and Barnabas. When Paul returned to the holy city from his third missionary journey, he was met by the Christian church there. The apostles allowed the Holy Spirit to lead them. It would break the spirit of the church for them to flee. But later, God would send them forth one by one to do his bidding. But for now, God put his great invisible wing over those that dare remain. Angels ascended and descended on the commands of the Son of Man to aid his church and confound the opposers. The Sanhedrists were delighted to have put an end to the public preaching of the Nazarene in the temple, but now all Israel will hear their doctrines in every town. Now they will have to travel far and wide to try to stamp out these fanatics for Jesus. But now these heretics of truth will leaven all the loaf of Israel with their doctrine. Now they will be much harder to ferret out, for surely they will be more discreet, holding home meetings and witnessing privately only to those who show some interest. Thus the disciple learned to be as wise as serpents, to discern the reaction of the listeners as they opened the door of inquiry wider and wider. They would learn to be selective and able readers of others. But only one Pharisee was willing to leave home and continue the persecution, and already God above had his ox goad in his shoulder. Soon he will quit kicking against the pricks, and he will drop to his knees and learn of Jesus, whom he sought to persecute. This leading Jew, when converted, will preach Jesus openly throughout the whole of Asia zealously. But for now, The apostles, held in great esteem by the masses, were left untouched except for threats and accusations. And Jesus was pleased to see his name continue in Jerusalem and spread throughout the land and beyond as far as Phoenix and Crete, Cyprus, 46 miles south of Asia Minor, 60 miles west of Syria in the Mediterranean Sea, and Antioch.